Rosie said. And there was. The Temple of the Bull. Before going to bed that Thursday night, Rosie plugged in her new phone again and used it to call Anna. She asked if Anna had heard anything new or if anyone had seen Norman in the city. Anna gave a firm no to both questions, told her all was quiet, and then offered the old one about no news being good news. Rosie had her doubts about that, but kept them to herself. Instead, she offered Anna hesitant condolences on the loss of her ex-husband, wondering if Miss Manners had rules for handling such situations. "Thanks, Rosie," Anna said. "Peter was a strange and difficult man. He loved people, but he wasn't very lovable himself. He seemed very nice to me." "I'm sure. To strangers, he was the Good Samaritan. To his family and the people who tried to be his friends, I belong to both groups, so I know, he was more like the Levite who passed by on the other side. Once, during Thanksgiving dinner, he picked up the turkey and threw it at his brother Hal. I can't remember for sure what the argument was about, but it was probably either the PLO or Cesar Chavez. It was usually one or the other." Anna sighed. "There's going to be a remembrance circle for him Saturday afternoon. We all sit around in folding chairs, like drunks at an AA meeting, and take turns talking about him. At least I think that's what we do." "It sounds nice." "Do you think so?" Anna asked. Rosie could imagine her arching her eyebrows in that unconsciously arrogant way of hers and looking more like Maud than ever. "I think it sounds rather silly, but perhaps you're right. Anyway, I'll leave the picnic long enough to do that, but I'll come back with only a few regrets. The battered women of this city have lost a friend. There's no doubt about that much." "If it was Norman who did it..."
"I knew that was coming," Anna said. "I've been working with women who've been bent, folded, stapled, and mutilated for a lot of years, and I know the masochistic grandiosity they develop. It's as much a part of the battered woman syndrome as the dissociation and the depression. Do you remember when the space shuttle Challenger exploded?"
"Yes." Rosie was mystified, but she remembered all right.
"Later that day, I had a woman come to me in tears. There were red marks all over her cheeks and arms. She'd been slapping and pinching herself. She said it was her fault those men and that nice woman teacher had died. When I asked why, she explained she'd written not one but two letters supporting the manned space program, one to the Chicago Tribune and one to the U.S. representative from her district. After a while, battered women start accepting the blame, that's all. And not just for some things, either. For everything." Rosie thought of Bill walking her back to the corn building with his arm around her waist. "Don't say fault," he'd told her. "You didn't make Norman." "I didn't understand that part of the syndrome for a long time," Anna said. "But now I think I do. Someone has to be to blame, or all the pain and depression and isolation make no sense. You go crazy. Better to be guilty than crazy. But it's time for you to get past that choice, Rosie."
"I don't understand."
"Yes, you do," Anna said calmly. And from there they had passed on to other subjects. 20 minutes after saying goodbye to Anna, Rosie lay in bed with her eyes open and her fingers laced together under her pillow, looking up into the darkness as faces floated through her mind like untethered balloons. Rob Lefferts, looking like Mr. Pennybags on the yellow community chess cards. She saw him offering her one that said, "Get out of jail, free." Rhoda Simons, with a pencil stuck in her hair, telling Rosie it was nylon stockings, not nylon strokings. Gert Kinshaw, a human version of the planet Jupiter, wearing sweatpants and a man's V-necked undershirt, both size extra, extra, extra large. Cynthia someone, Rosie still couldn't quite remember her last name, the cheerful punk rocker with a two-tone hair, saying she had once sat for hours in front of a picture where the river had actually seemed to be moving. And Bill, of course. She saw his hazel eyes with the green undertints, saw the way his dark hair grew back from his temples, saw even the tiny circle of scar on his right earlobe, which he'd once had pierced, perhaps back in college, as the result of a drunken dare, and then allowed to grow back over. She felt the touch of his hand on her waist, warm palm, strong fingers, felt the occasional brush of her hip against his, and wondered if he had been excited touching her. She was now willing to admit that the touch had certainly excited her. He was so different from Norman that it was like meeting a visitor from another star system. She closed her eyes, drifted deeper. Another face came floating out of the darkness. Norman's face. Norman was smiling, but his gray eyes were as cold as chips of ice. "I'm trolling for you, sweetie," Norman said. "Lying in my own bed, not all that far away, and trolling for you. Pretty soon I'll be talking to you. Right up close, I'll be talking to you. Should be a fairly short conversation. And when it's over..." He raised his hand. There was a pencil in it, a Mongol number 2. It had been sharpened to a razor point. "This time, I won't bother with your arms or shoulders. This time, I'm going straight for your eyes. Or maybe your tongue. How do you think that would be, sweetie? Having a pencil driven straight through your quacking, lying t—" Her eyes flew open, and Norman's face disappeared. She closed them again and summoned Bill's face. For a moment, she was sure it wouldn't come, that Norman's face would return instead. But it didn't. "We're going out on Saturday," she thought. "We're going to spend the day together. If he wants to kiss me, I'll let him. If he wants to hold me and touch me, I'll let him. It's nuts how much I want to be with him." She began to drift again, and now she supposed she must be dreaming about the picnic she and Bill were going on the day after tomorrow. Someone else was picnicking nearby, someone with a baby. She could hear it crying, very faintly. Then louder came a rumble of thunder. "Like in my picture," she thought. "I'll tell him about my picture while we eat. I forgot to tell him today, because there were so many other things to talk about. But..." The thunder rolled again, closer and sharper. This time the sound filled her with dismay. Rain would spoil their picnic. Rain would wash out the daughters and sisters' picnic at Ettinger's Pier. Rain might even cause the concert to be canceled. "Don't worry, Rosie, the thunder's only in the picture, and this is all a dream." But if it was a dream, how come she could still feel the pillow lying on her wrists and forearms? How come she could still feel her fingers laced together and the light blanket lying on top of her? How come she could still hear city traffic outside her window? Crickets sang and hummed, reep, 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 reep. The baby cried. The insides of her eyelids suddenly flashed purple as if with lightning, and the thunder rolled again, closer than ever. Rosie gasped and sat up straight in bed, her heart thumping hard in her chest. There was no lightning, no thunder. She thought she could still hear crickets, yes, but that might just have been her ears playing tricks on her. She looked across the room toward the window and made out the shadowy rectangle leaning against the wall below it. The picture of Rose Madder. Tomorrow she would slip it into a grocery sack and take it to work with her. Rhoda or Kurt would probably know a place nearby where she could get it reframed. Still, faintly, she could hear crickets. From the park, she thought, lying back down. Even with the window closed? Practical Sensible asked. She sounded dubious, but not really anxious. "Are you sure, Rosie?" Sure she was. It was almost summer, after all. Lots more crickets for your buck, shoppers. What difference did it make anyhow? All right, maybe there was something odd about the picture. More likely, the oddities were in her own mind, where the final kinks were still being worked out. But say it really was the picture. So what? She sensed no actual badness about it. But can you say it doesn't feel dangerous, Rosie? Now there was a touch of anxiety in Practical Sensible's voice. Never mind evil or badness or whatever you want to call it, can you say it doesn't feel dangerous? No, she couldn't say that. But on the other hand, there was danger everywhere. Just look at what happened to Anna Stevenson's ex-husband. Except she didn't want to look at what happened to Peter Slowick. She didn't want to go back down what was sometimes called Guilty Street in therapy circle. She wanted to think about Saturday and what it might feel like to be kissed by Bill Steiner. Would he put his hands on her shoulders or around her waist? What exactly would his mouth feel like on hers? Would he... Rosie's head slipped over to the side. Thunder rumbled. The crickets hummed louder than ever. And now one of them began to hop across the floor toward the bed, but Rosie didn't notice. This time the string tethering her mind to her body had broken, and she floated away into darkness. A flash of light woke her, not purple this time, but a brilliant white. It was followed by thunder, not a rumble, but a roar. Rosie sat up in bed, gasping, clutching the top blanket to her neck. There was another flash, and in it she saw her table, the kitchen counter, the little sofa that was really not much more than a love seat, the door to the tiny bathroom standing open, the daisy-printed shower curtain run back on its rings. The light was so bright and her eyes so unprepared that she continued to see these things even after the room had fallen dark again, only with the colors reversed. She realized she could still hear the baby crying, but the crickets had stopped, and a wind was blowing. That she could feel as well as hear. It lifted her hair from her temples, and she heard the rattle, slither, flump of pages. She had left the Xerox sides of the next Richard Racine novel on the table, and the wind had sent them cascading all over the floor. "This is no dream," she thought, and swung her feet out of bed. As she did, she looked toward the window, and her breath stuck solid in her throat. Either the window was gone, or the wall had become all window. In any case, the view was no longer of Tremont Street and Bryant Park. It was of a woman in a rose madder chiton standing on top of an overgrown hill, looking down at the ruins of a temple. But now the hem of her short gown was rippling against the woman's long, smooth thighs. Now Rosie could see the fine blonde hairs which had escaped her plait wavering like plankton in the wind, and the purple-black thunderheads rushing across the sky. Now she could see the shaggy pony's head move as it cropped grass. And if it was a window, it was wide open. As she watched, the pony poked its muzzle into her room, sniffed at the floorboards, found them uninteresting, pulled back, and began to crop on its own side once more. More lightning, another roll of thunder. The wind gusted again, and Rosie heard the spilled pages stirring and swirling around in the kitchen alcove. The hem of her nightgown fluttered against her legs as she got up and walked slowly toward the picture, which now covered the whole wall from floor to ceiling and side to side. The wind blew back her hair, and she could smell sweet, impending rain. "It won't be long now, either," she thought. "I'm going to get drenched. We all are, I guess." "Rose, what are you thinking?" Practical Sensible screamed. "What in God's name are you—" Rosie squashed the voice. At that moment it seemed she had heard enough of it to last her a lifetime, and stopped before the wall that was no longer a wall. Just ahead, no more than 5 feet away, was the blonde woman in the chiton. She hadn't turned, but Rosie could now see the little tilts and adjustments of her upraised hand as she looked down the hill, and the rise and fall of her barely glimpsed left breast as she breathed. Rosie took a deep breath and stepped into the picture. It was at least 10 degrees cooler on the other side, and the high grass tickled her ankles and shins. For a moment she thought she heard a baby crying again, very faintly, but then the sound was gone. She looked back over her shoulder, expecting to see her room, but it was gone too. A gnarled old olive tree spread its roots and branches at the place where she had stepped through into this world. Beneath it, she saw an artist's easel with a stool in front of it. Standing open on the stool was a painter's box full of brushes and colors. The canvas propped on the easel was exactly the size of the picture Rosie had bought in the Liberty City Loan and Pawn. It showed her room on Trenton Street, as seen from the wall where she had hung Rose Madder. There was a woman, clearly Rosie herself, standing in the middle of the room, facing the door which gave on the second-floor hallway. Her posture and position were not quite the same as the posture and position of the woman looking down on the ruined temple. Her hand was not upraised, for instance, but it was close enough to frighten Rosie badly. There was something else frightening about the picture as well. The woman had on dark blue tapered slacks and a pink sleeveless top. This was the outfit Rosie had already planned to wear when she went motorcycling with Bill. "I'll have to wear something different," she thought wildly, as if by changing her clothes in the future she could change what she was seeing now. Something nuzzled her upper arm, and Rosie gave a small scream. She turned and saw the pony looking at her with apologetic brown eyes. Overhead, thunder rumbled. A woman was standing beside the trim pony cart to which the shaggy little beast was harnessed. She was wearing a many-layered red robe. It was ankle-length, but gauzy, almost transparent. Rosie could see the warm tints of her café au lait skin through its artful layers. Lightning flared across the sky. And for a moment, Rosie again saw what she had first seen in the painting, not long after Bill had brought her back from Pop's kitchen. The shadow of the cart lying on the grass, and the shadow of the woman growing out of it.
"Don't you worry now," the woman in the red robe said. "Rhadamanthus the least of your worries. He don't bite nothing but grass and clover. He's just getting a little smell on you, that's all."
Rosie felt a sudden overwhelming sense of relief as she realized that this was the woman Norman had always referred to, in tones of aggrieved bitterness, as that slutty high yellow gal. It was Wendy Yarrow, but Wendy Yarrow was dead, and so this was a dream, QED. No matter how realistic it felt or how realistic the details might be, wiping a tiny bit of moisture off her upper arm, for instance, left there by the pony's inquiring muzzle, it was a dream. "Of course it is," she told herself. "No one actually steps through pictures, Rosie." That had little or no power over her. The idea that the woman attending the cart was the long-dead Wendy Yarrow did, however. The wind gusted, and once again the sound of the crying baby came to her. Now Rosie saw something else. Sitting on the pony cart's seat was a large basket made of green woven rushes. Fluffs of silk ribbon decorated the handle, and there were silk bows on the corners. The hem of a pink blanket, clearly hand-woven, hung over the end. "Rosie?" The voice was low and sweetly husky. Nevertheless, it sent a scutter of goose flesh up Rosie's back. There was something wrong with it, and she had an idea that wrongness might be something only another woman could hear. A man heard a voice like that, immediately thought about sex and forgot everything else. But there was something wrong with it. Badly wrong. "Rosie," it said again, and suddenly she knew. It was as if the voice were striving to be human, striving to remember how to be human.
"Girl, don't you look straight at her," the woman in the red robe said. She sounded anxious. "That's not for the likes of you."
"No, I don't want to," Rosie said. "I want to go home."
"I don't blame you, but it's too late for that," the woman said, and stroked the pony's neck.
Her dark eyes were grave and her mouth was tight.
"Don't touch her, either. She don't mean you no harm, but she ain't got good control of herself no more."
She tapped her temple with one finger. Rosie turned reluctantly toward the woman in the chiton and took a single step forward. She was fascinated by the texture of the woman's back, her bare shoulder and the lower part of her neck. The skin was finer than watered silk.
But farther up on her neck...
Rosie didn't know what those gray shadows lurking just below her hairline could be, and didn't think she wanted to know. Bites were her first wild thought, but they weren't bites. Rosie knew bites. Was it leprosy? Something worse? Something contagious? Rosie, the sweet husky voice said for the third time, and there was something in it that made Rosie feel like screaming the way that seeing Norman's smile had sometimes made her feel like screaming. The woman is mad. Whatever else is wrong with her, the patches on her skin, is secondary to that. She is mad. Lightning flashed, thunder rumbled, and on the fitfully gusting wind from the direction of the ruined temple at the foot of the hill came the distant wail of an infant. "Who are you?" she asked. "Who are you, and why am I here?" For an answer, the woman held out her right arm and turned it over, revealing an old white ring of scar on the underside. "This one bled quite a bit, then got infected," she said in her sweetly husky voice. Rosie held out her own arm. It was the left instead of the right, but the mark itself was exactly the same. A small but terrible packet of knowledge came to her then. If she were to put on the short rose madder chiton, she would wear it so that her right shoulder was bare instead of her left. And if she were to own the gold armlet, the woman on the hill was her mirror image. The woman on the hill was...
"You're me, aren't you?"
Rosie asked. And then, as the woman with the plaited hair shifted slightly, she added in a shrill, shaking voice, "Don't turn around. I don't want to see."
"Don't jump so fast," Rose Madder said in a strange, patient voice. "You're really Rosie. You're Rosie real. Don't forget that when you forget everything else. And don't forget one other thing. I repay. What you do for me, I will do for you. And that's why we were brought together. That is our balance. That is our ka."
Lightning ripped the sky, thunder cracked, wind hissed through the olive tree. The tiny blonde hairs which had escaped from Rose Madder's plait wavered wildly. Even in this chancy light, they looked like filaments of gold.
"Go down now," Rose Madder said. "Go down and bring me my baby."
The child's cry drifted up to them like something which had labored here from another continent, and Rosie looked down at the ruined temple, whose perspective still seemed strangely and unpleasantly skewed, with new fear. Also, her breasts had begun to throb, as they had often throbbed in the months following her miscarriage. Rosie opened her mouth, not sure of the words that would come out, only knowing they would be some sort of protest. But a hand gripped her shoulder before she could speak. She turned. It was the woman in red. She shook her head warningly, tapped her temple again, and pointed down the hill at the ruins. Rosie's right wrist was seized by another hand, one as cold as a gravestone. She turned back and realized at the last moment that the woman in the chiton had turned around and was now facing her. Quickly, with confused thoughts of Medusa filling her mind, Rosie cast her eyes down so as not to see the face of the other. She saw the back of the hand gripping her wrist instead. It was covered with a dark gray blotch that made her think of some hovering ocean predator, a manta ray, of course. The fingernails looked dark and dead. As Rosie watched, she saw a small white worm wiggle out from beneath one of them.
"Go now," Rose Madder said. "Do for me what I cannot do for myself. And remember, I repay."
"All right," Rosie said. A terrible, perverse desire to look up into the other woman's face had seized her, to see what was there. Perhaps to see her own face swimming beneath the dead gray shadows of some ailment that made you crazy, even as it ate you alive. The hand let go of her wrist, but slowly, as if it would clamp tight again the instant its owner sensed any weakening on Rosie's part. Then the hand turned, and one dead gray finger pointed down the hill, as the ghost of Christmas yet to come had pointed out one particular grave marker to Ebenezer Scrooge.
"Go on, then," Rose Madder said. Rosie started slowly down the hill, eyes still lowered, watching her bare feet slip through the high, rough grass. It wasn't until a particularly vicious crack of thunder tore through the air and she looked up, startled, that she realized the woman in the red robe had come with her. "Are you going to help me?" Rosie asked.
"I can only go that far," the woman in red pointed toward the fallen pillar. "I got what she got, only so far it hasn't done much more than brush me."
She held out an arm and Rosie saw an amorphous pink blotch squirming on her flesh, in her flesh, between the wrist and the forearm. There was a similar one in the cup of her palm. This one was almost pretty. It reminded Rosie of the clover she had found between the floorboards in her room. Her room, the place she had counted on to be her refuge, seemed very distant to her now. Perhaps that was the dream, that whole life, and this was the only reality.
"These are the only two I got, at least for now," she said, "but they're enough to keep me out of there. That bull would smell me and come running. It's me it'd come to, but both of us'd get killed."
"What bull?" Rosie asked, mystified and afraid. They had almost reached the fallen pillar.
"Erinyes. He guards the temple."
"What temple?"
"Don't waste time with man's questions, woman."
"What are you talking about? What are man's questions?"
"Ones you already know the answers to. Come on over here."
Wendy Yarrow was standing by the moss-encrusted end segment of the fallen pillar and looking impatiently at Rosie. The temple loomed close by. Looking at it hurt Rosie's eyes in the same way that looking at a movie screen where the picture had gone out of focus hurt them. She saw subtle bulges where she was sure there were none. She saw folds of shadow which disappeared when she blinked her eyes.
"Erinyes is one-eyed, and that one eye is blind, but there ain't nothing wrong with his sense of smell. Is it your time, girl?"
"My time?"
"Time of the month."
Rosie shook her head.
"Good, 'cause we'd have been done before we was begun if you was. I ain't neither. Ain't had no woman blood since the sickness started to show. Too bad, 'cause that blood would be best. Still..."
The most monstrous crack of thunder yet split the air open just above their heads, and now icy droplets of rain began to fall.
"We got to hurry,"
the woman in red told her.
"Tear off 2 pieces of your nightgown, a strip for a bandage, and a swatch big enough to wrap a stone in, with enough left over to tie it up. Don't argue, and don't go asking no more questions, neither. Just do it."
Rosie bent down, took hold of the hem of her cotton nightgown, and tore a long, wide strip up the side, leaving her left leg bare almost all the way to the hip. "When I walk, I'm going to look like a waitress in a Chinese restaurant," she thought. She tore a narrower strip from the side of this, and when she looked up, she was alarmed to see that Wendy was holding a long and wicked-looking double-sided dagger. Rose couldn't think where it might have come from, unless the woman had had it strapped to her thigh, like the heroine in one of those sweet, savage Paul Sheldon novels, stories where there was a reason, no matter how far-fetched, for everything that happened. That's probably just where she had it, too, Rosie thought. She knew that she herself would want a knife if she was traveling in the company of the woman in the Rose Matter chiton. She thought again about how the woman who was traveling in her company had tapped the side of her head with one finger and told Rosie not to touch her.
"She don't mean no harm," Wendy Yarrow had said, "but she ain't got good control of herself no more."
Rosie opened her mouth to ask the woman standing by the fallen pillar what she intended doing with that knife, and then closed her lips again. If a man's questions were ones you already knew the answers to, then that was a man's question. Wendy seemed to feel her eyes and looked up at her.
"It's the big piece you'll want first," she said. "Be ready with it."
Before Rosie could answer, Wendy had pierced her own skin with the tip of the dagger. She hissed a few words Rosie didn't understand, maybe a prayer, and then drew a fine line across her forearm, one that matched her dress. It fattened and began to run as the skin and underlying tissue drew back, allowing the wound to gape.
"Woo, that hurt bad,"
the woman moaned, then held out the hand with the dagger in it.
"Give it to me, the big piece, the big piece."
Rosie put it in her hand, confused and frightened, but not nauseated. The sight of blood did not do that to her. Wendy Yarrow folded the strip of cotton cloth into a pad which she placed over the wound, held, then turned over. Her purpose did not appear to be compression. She only wanted to soak the cloth with her blood. When she handed it back to Rosie, the cotton, which had been cornflower blue when Rosie lay down in her Trenton Street bed, was a much darker color, but a familiar one. Blue and scarlet had combined to make Rose Madder.
"Now find a rock and tie that piece of cloth round it," she said to Rosie. "When you got that done, take off that thing you're wearing and wrap it around both."
Rosie stared at her with wide eyes, far more shocked by this order than she had been by the sight of the blood pouring off the woman's arm.
"I can't do that," she said. "I don't have anything on underneath."
Wendy grinned humorlessly.
"I won't tell if you won't," she said. "Meantime, give me that other one before I bleed to death."
Rosie handed her the narrower strip of cloth, this one still blue, and the brown-skinned woman began to wrap it swiftly around her wounded arm. Lightning exploded on their left like some monstrous firework. Rosie heard a tree go over with a long, rending crash. This sound was followed by a cannonade of thunder. Now she could smell a coppery odor on the air, like pennies that had been flash-fried. Then, as if the lightning had ripped open the sky's bag of waters, the rain arrived. It fell in cold torrents, driven almost horizontal by the wind. Rosie saw it hit the pad of cloth in her hand, making it steam, and saw the first runnels of pink, bloody water coming out of it and trickling down her fingers. It looked like strawberry Kool-Aid. Without any further thought about what she was doing or why, Rosie reached over her shoulder, grasped the back of her nightgown, bowed forward, and stripped it off over her head. She was immediately standing in the world's coldest shower, gasping for breath as the rain needled her cheeks and shoulders and unprotected back. Her skin tightened and then broke out in hundreds of tiny hard goose pimples. They covered her from neck to heels. She cried in a desperate, breathless little voice. "Oh, so cold!" She dropped her nightgown, still mostly dry, over the hand holding the bloody rag, and spied a rock the size of a cinnamon bun lying between two of the fallen pillar's segments. She picked it up, dropped to her knees, and then spread her nightgown over her head and shoulders, much as a man caught in an unexpected shower might use his newspaper as a makeshift tent. Under this temporary protection, she wrapped the blood-soaked rag around the rock. She was left with two long, sticky ears, and these she tied together, wincing with disgust, as Wendy's rain-thinned blood ran out of them and pattered to the ground. With the rock tied in the rag, she wrapped her nightgown, no longer even close to dry, around the whole thing, as instructed. Most of the blood was going to wash out anyway, she knew. This wasn't a shower or even a downpour. This was a flood.
"Go on," the brown-skinned woman in the red dress told her. "Go on in the temple. Walk right through it, and don't stop for nothing. Don't pick nothing up, and don't believe in anything you see or hear. It's a ghost place, no doubt about that, but even in the Temple of the Bull, there ain't no ghost can hurt a living woman."
Rosie was shivering wildly, water in her eyes doubling her vision, water dripping from the tip of her nose, drops of water hanging from the lobes of her ears like exotic jewelry. Wendy stood facing her, hair plastered to her brow and cheeks, dark eyes blazing. Now she had to shout in order to make herself heard over the relentlessly rising wind.
"Pass through the door on the other side of the altar, and you're going to find yourself in a garden where all the plants and flowers are dead. Across the garden, you're going to see a grove of trees, all of them dead, too, all except one. In between the garden and the grove, there runs a stream. You dasn't drink from it, no matter how much you might want to. Dasn't, or even touch it. Use the stepping stones to get across. Wet so much as a single finger in that water, you're going to forget everything you ever knew, even your own name."
Electricity raced through the clouds in a glare of light, turning the thunderheads into strangulated goblin faces. Rosie had never been so cold in her life, or so aware of her heart's strange exhilaration as it tried to force a flush of heat to her rain-chilled skin. And the thought came to her again,
This was no more a dream than the water cascading down from the sky was a sprinkle.
Go in the grove, into the dead trees. The one tree still living is a pomegranate tree. Gather the seeds that you find in the fruit around the base of that tree, but don't taste the fruit or even put the hand that touches the seeds into your mouth. Go down the stairs by the tree and into the halls beneath. Find the baby and bring her out. But where the bull? Where the bull, Erinyes? Now go, hurry.
She was afraid of the temple of the bull, with its curiously twisted perspectives. So it was something of a relief for Rosie to discover that her desperate desire to get out of the storm had now superseded everything. She wanted to get away from the wind and rain and lightning, but she also wanted to be under cover in case the rain decided to turn to hail. She found the idea of being naked in a hailstorm, even if it was a dream, extremely unpleasant. She went a few steps, then turned back to look at the other woman. Wendy looked as naked as Rosie did herself, her gauzy red gown now plastered to her body like paint.
"Who's Erinyes?" Rosie shouted. "What is he?"
She ventured a glance at the temple over her shoulder, almost as if she expected the god to come at the sound of her voice. No god appeared. There was only the temple shimmering in the downpour. The brown-skinned woman rolled her eyes.
"Why you act so stupid, girl?" she yelled back. "Go on now. Go on, while you still can."
And she pointed wordlessly at the temple, much as her mistress had done. Rosie, naked and white, holding the soaked ball of her nightgown against her stomach to protect it as much as she could, started toward the temple. 5 paces took her to the fallen stone head lying in the grass. She peered down at it, expecting to see Norman. Of course it would be Norman, and she might as well be prepared for it. That was the way things worked in dreams. Except it wasn't. The receding hairline, fleshy cheeks, and luxurious David Crosby mustache belonged to the man who'd been leaning in the doorway of the Wee Nip Tavern on the day Rosie had gotten lost looking for daughters and sisters.
"I'm lost again," she thought. "Oh, boy, am I."
She walked past the fallen stone head with its empty eyes that seemed to be weeping, and the long, wet strand of weed that lay across its cheek and brow like a green scar, and it seemed to be whispering from behind her as she approached the strangely configured temple. "Hey, baby, want to get it on? Nice tits, what do you say? Want to get it on? Want to do some low riding? Want to do the dog? What do you say?" She walked up the steps, which were slippery and treacherous with overgrown vines and creepers, and seemed to sense that head rolling on its stone cranium, squelching muddy water up from the soaked earth, wanting to watch the flecks of her bare bottom as she climbed toward the darkness.
"Don't think about it, don't think about it, don't think."
She resisted the urge to run, both from the rain and from that imagined stare, and went on picking her way, avoiding the places where the stone had been cracked open by the elements, leaving jagged gaps where one might twist or even break an ankle. Nor was that the worst possibility. Who knew what sorts of poisonous things might be coiled up in those dark places, waiting to sting or bite? Water dripped from her shoulder blades and ran straight down the course of her spine, and she was colder than ever. But she nevertheless stopped on the top step, looking at the carving above the temple's wide, dark doorway. She hadn't been able to see it in her picture. It had been lost in the darkness under the roof's overhang. It showed a hard-faced boy leaning against what could have been a telephone pole. His hair fell over his forehead, and the collar of his jacket was turned up. A cigarette hung from his lower lip, and his slouched, hip-shot posture proclaimed him as Mr. Totally Cool, late 70s edition. And what else did that posture say?
"Hey, baby," was what it said. Hey, baby, want to get down? Want to do some low riding? Want to do the dog with me?" It was Norman.
"No," she whispered. It was almost a moan. "Oh, no."
Oh, yes, it was Norman, all right.
Norman when he had still been the ghost of beatings yet to come. Norman leaning against the phone pole on the corner of State Street and Highway 49 in downtown Aubreyville. Downtown Aubreyville? Now there was a joke. Norman watching the cars go by while the sound of the Bee Gees singing You Should Be Dancing came drifting out of Finnegan's Pub, where the door had been chalked open and the Seaburg turned up loud. The wind dropped momentarily, and Rosie could hear the baby crying again. It didn't sound hurt, exactly, rather as if it might be very hungry. The faint howls got her eyes off that wretched carving and got her bare feet moving, but just before she passed into the temple doorway, she looked up again. She couldn't help herself. The boy Norman was gone, if he had ever been there at all. Now she saw carved words directly above her. Suck my AIDS-infected cock, they said. Nothing stays steady in dreams, she thought. They're like water. She looked back over her shoulder and saw Wendy, still standing by the fallen pillar, looking bedraggled in the collapsed cobwebs of her dress. Rosie raised the hand that wasn't holding the wadded nightgown in a tentative wave. Wendy raised her own hand in return, then just stood watching, seemingly oblivious of the pelting rain. Rosie stepped through the wide, cool doorway and into the temple. She stood at the back, tense, ready to dart out again at once if she saw, well, if she saw, she didn't know what. Wendy had told her not to sweat the ghosts, but Rosie thought the woman in the red dress could afford to be sanguine. She was back there, after all. She guessed it was warmer inside than out, but it didn't feel warmer. There was the deep chill of damp stone about the place, the chill of crypts and mausoleums, and for a moment she wasn't sure she could make herself walk up the shadowy aisle, scattered with long dead drifts and swirls of autumn leaves which lay ahead of her. It was just too cold, and cold in too many ways. She stood shivering and gasping for breath in short little pulls of air, with her arms crossed tightly over her breasts and little ribbons of steam rising from her skin. She touched her left nipple with the tip of her finger and was not much surprised to find it was like touching a chip of rock. It was the thought of going back to the woman on the hill that got her moving, the thought of having to face Rose Matter empty-handed. She stepped into the aisle, moving slowly and carefully, listening to the distant howl of the infant. It sounded miles away, carried to her by some thin, magical communication. Go down and bring me my baby. Caroline. The name she had planned to give her own baby, the one Norman had beaten out of her, came easily and naturally to her mind. The fugitive throb in her breasts began again. She touched them and winced. They were tender. Her eyes were adjusting to the gloom now, and it occurred to her that the Temple of the Bull had a strangely Christian look to it, that it looked, in fact, quite a bit like the First Methodist Church of Aubreyville, where she had gone twice a week until she had married Norman. First Methodist was where that marriage had taken place, and it was from there that her father, mother, and kid brother had been buried after the road accident which had taken their lives. There were rows of old wooden pews, the ones at the back overturned and half buried in drifts of cinnamon-smelling leaves. Closer down toward the front, they were still upright and ranked in neat rows. Lying on them at regular intervals were fat black books that might have been the Methodist book of hymns and praise Rosie had grown up with. The next thing she became aware of, this as she walked down the center aisle like some strange naked bride, was the smell of the place. Under the good smell of the leaves which had blown in through the open door over the years, there lurked a less pleasant odor. It was a little like mold, a little like mildew, a little like late-stage decay, and really not like any of those things. Old sweat, perhaps? Yes, perhaps. And perhaps other fluids as well. Semen came to her mind. So did blood. After her awareness of the smell came the almost undeniable sensation of being watched by malevolent eyes.
She sensed them studying her nakedness carefully, brooding over it, perhaps, marking each undraped curve and line, memorizing the movement of her muscles beneath her wet, sleek skin.
"Talk to you up close," the temple seemed to sigh to her beneath the hollow drumming of the rain and crackle of the old leaves beneath her bare feet. "Talk to you right up close. But we won't have to talk long to say the things we need to say, will we, Rosie?"
She stopped near the front of the temple and picked up one of the black books from where it lay in the second pew. When she opened it, a gasp of putrefaction so strong it almost choked her wafted up. The picture at the top of the page was a stark line drawing which had never appeared in the Methodist hymnals of her youth. It showed a woman on her knees performing fellatio on a man whose feet were not feet at all, but hooves. His face was suggested rather than actually rendered, but Rosie saw a hideous similarity just the same, or thought she did. He looked like Norman's old partner, Harley Bissington, who had always checked her hem so assiduously whenever she sat down. Below the drawing, the yellowed page was crammed with Cyrillic lettering, unreadable but familiar. It took her only a moment of thought to understand why. They were the same letters which had filled the newspaper Peter Slowick had been reading when she had approached the traveler's aid booth and asked him for help. Then, with shocking suddenness, the drawing began to move, its lines seeming to crawl toward her white, rain-wrinkled fingers, leaving little snail trails of sludge behind. It was alive, somehow. She slammed the book shut, and her throat clenched at the wet, squelching noise that came from inside it. She dropped it, and either the bang it made when it hit the pew or her own revolted cry woke a flutter of bats in the shadowy area she supposed was the choir loft. Several of them turned aimless figure eights overhead, black wings dragging loathsomely plump brown bodies through the dank air, and then they retreated back into their holes. Ahead was the altar, and she was relieved to see a narrow door standing open to its left and letting in an oblong of clean, white light. She refused to look around. She kept her eyes fixed on the door and the daylight beyond it. The rain had abated, the hollow rushing sound from overhead now down to a steady, low mutter.
"It's for men only, Rosie," the temple whispered, and then added what Norman always said when he didn't want to answer one of her questions, but wasn't really mad at her either. "It's a guy thing."
She looked into the altar area as she passed by it, then quickly looked away. It was empty. There was no pulpit, no symbols, no arcane books. But she saw another hovering manta shadow, this one lying on the bare stones. Its rusty color suggested to her that it was blood, and the size of the shadow suggested that a lot of it had been spilled here over the years. A lot.
"It's like the Roach Motel, Rosie," the room whispered, and the leaves on the stone floor stirred, making a sound like laughter slipping between gumless teeth. "They check in, but they don't check out."
She walked steadily toward the door, trying to ignore that voice, keeping her eyes fixed straight ahead. She half expected it to slam shut in her face when she got close to it, but it didn't. No capering bogey with Norman's face leaped through it either. She stepped out onto a small stone stoop, stepped into the cool smell of rain-freshened grass, and into air which had begun to warm again, even though the rain had not completely stopped. Water dripped and rustled everywhere. Thunder boomed, but it was going away thunder now, she felt sure. And the baby, of which she had not been aware for several minutes, resumed its distant wailing. The garden was divided into two parts, flowers on the left, veggies on the right. But it was all dead, cataclysmically dead. And the lush greenery which surrounded it and the Temple of the Bull, like encircling arms, made that dead acre look so much the worse by contrast, like a corpse with its eyes open and its tongue lolling. Huge sunflowers with yellow fibrous stalks, brown centers, and curling faded petals towered over everything else, like diseased turnkeys in a prison where all the inmates have died. The flower beds were full of blown petals that made her think, in an instant of nightmarish recall, of what she had seen when she had gone back to the cemetery where her family was buried a month after their interment. She had walked to the back of the little graveyard, after putting fresh flowers on their graves, wanting to collect herself, and had been horrified to find drifts of rotting flowers piled in the declivity between the stone wall and the woods behind the cemetery. The stink of their dying perfume had made her think of what was happening to her mother and father and brother under the ground, how they were changing. Rosie looked hastily away from the flowers, but at first what she saw in the moribund vegetable patch was no better. One of the rows appeared to be full of blood. She wiped water out of her eyes, looked again, and sighed with relief. Not blood, but tomatoes. A 20-foot row of fallen, rotting tomatoes. Rosie? Not the temple this time. This was Norman's voice. It was right behind her. And she suddenly realized she could smell Norman's cologne. All my men wear English leather, or they wear nothing at all, she thought, and felt ice creep up her spine. He was behind her, right behind her, reaching for her. No, I don't believe that. I don't believe it, even if I do. That was a completely stupid thought, of course, probably stupid enough to rate at least a small entry in the Guinness Book of Records, but it steadied her somehow. Moving slowly, knowing if she tried to go even a little faster, she was apt to lose it completely, Rosie went down the 3 stone steps, much humbler even than those at the front of the building, and into the remains of what she mentally named Bull Gardens. The rain was still falling, but gently, and the wind had dropped to a sigh. Rosie walked down an aisle formed by 2 ranks of brown and leaning cornstalks. There was no way she was going to walk through those rotting tomatoes in her bare feet, feeling them burst beneath her soles. Listening to the stony roar of a nearby stream, the sound grew steadily louder as she walked, and when she stepped out of the corn, she saw the stream flowing past less than 15 feet away. It was perhaps 10 feet across, and ordinarily shallow, judging from its mild banks. But now it was swollen with runoff from the downpour. Only the tops of the 4 large white stones which crossed it showed, like the bleached shells of turtles. The water of the stream was a tarry, lightless black. She walked slowly toward it, barely aware that she was squeezing her hair with her free hand, wringing the water out of it. As she drew close, she smelled a peculiar mineral odor coming up from the stream, heavily metallic, yet oddly attractive. She was suddenly thirsty, very thirsty, her throat as parched as a hearthstone. "You dasn't drink from it, no matter how much you want to. Dasn't!" Yes, that was what she'd said. She'd told Rosie that if she wet so much as a finger in that water, she would forget everything she had ever known, even her own name. But was that such a bad deal? When you thought things over, was that really such a bad deal? Especially when one of the things she could forget was Norman, and the possibility that he wasn't done with her yet, that he had killed a man because of her. She swallowed and heard a dust-dry click in her throat. Again, acting with almost no awareness of what she was doing, Rosie ran a hand up her side, over the swell of her breast and across her neck, collecting moisture and then licking it out of her palm. This did not slake her thirst, but only fully awakened it. The water gleamed a slick black as it flowed around the stepping stones, and now that queerly attractive mineral smell seemed to fill her whole head. She knew how the water would taste, flat and airless like some cold syrup, and how it would fill her throat and belly with strange salts and exotic bromides, with the taste of memoryless earth. Then there would be no more thoughts of the day when Mrs. Pratt, white as snow she had been except for her lips, which were the color of blueberries, had come to the door and told her that her family, her whole family, had been killed in a highway wreck. No more thoughts of Norman with a pencil or Norman with a tennis racket. No more images of the man in the doorway of the Wee Nip, or the fat lady who would call the women at Daughters and Sisters welfare lesbians. No more dreams of sitting in the corner while the pain from her kidneys made her sick, reminding herself over and over to throw up in her apron if she had to throw up. Forgetting those things would be good. Some things deserved forgetting, and others, things like what he had done to her with the tennis racket, needed forgetting. Except most people never got the chance, not even in a dream. Rosie was trembling all over now, her eyes welded to the water flowing past like transparent silks filled with smooth black ink. Her throat burned like a brush fire, and her eyes pulsed in their sockets, and she could see herself going down flat on her belly, sticking her whole head into that blackness and drinking like a horse. "You'd forget Bill, too," Practical Sensible whispered almost apologetically. "You'd forget the green undertint in his eyes and the little scar on his earlobe. These days, some things are worth remembering, Rosie. You know that, don't you?" With no further hesitation, she didn't believe even the thought of Bill would have been able to save her if she'd waited much longer. Rosie stepped onto the first stone with her hands held out to either side for balance. Red-tinted water dripped steadily from the damp ball of her nightgown, and she could feel the rock at the center of the bundle like the pit in a peach. She stood with her left foot on the stone and her right on the bank, summoned up her courage, and put the foot behind her on the stone ahead of her. All right so far. She lifted her left foot and strode to the third stone. This time her balance shifted a little and she tottered to the right, waving her left arm to keep her balance while the babble of the strange water filled her ears. It was probably not as close as it seemed, and a moment later she was standing on the stones in the middle of the stream with her heartbeat thudding emphatically in her ears. Afraid she might freeze if she hesitated too long, Rosie stepped onto the last stone and then up to the dead grass of the far bank. She had taken only 3 steps toward the grove of bare trees ahead when she realized that her thirst had passed like a bad dream. It was as if giants had been buried alive here at some time in the past and had died trying to pull themselves out. The trees were their fleshless hands, reaching fruitlessly at the sky and silently speaking of murder. The dead branches were interlaced, creating strange geometric patterns against the sky. A path led into them. Guarding it was a stone boy with a huge erect phallus. His hands were held straight up over his head, as if he were signaling that the extra point was good. As Rosie passed, his pupilless stone eyes rolled toward her. She was sure of it. "Hey, baby," the stone boy spat inside her head. "Want to get down? Want to do the dog with me?" She backed away from it, raising her own hands in a warding-off gesture. But the stone boy was just a stone boy again. If, that was, he had been anything else, even for a moment. Water dripped from his comically oversized penis. No problems maintaining an erection there, Rosie thought, looking at the stone boy's pupilless eyes, and somehow too knowing smile. Had it been smiling before? Rosie tried to remember and found she couldn't. How Norman would envy you that. She hurried past the statue and along the path leading into the dead grove, restraining an urge to look over her shoulder and make sure that the statue wasn't following her, wanting to put that stone hard on to work. She didn't dare look. She was afraid her overstrained mind might see it, even if it wasn't there. The rain had backed off to a hesitant drizzle, and Rosie suddenly realized she could no longer hear the baby. Perhaps it had gone to sleep. Perhaps the bull Arinyes had gotten tired of listening to it and gobbled it like a canapé. In either case, how was she supposed to find it if it didn't cry? "One thing at a time, Rosie," Practical Sensible whispered. "Easy for you to say," Rosie whispered. She went on, listening to the rainwater drip from the dead trees and realizing reluctantly that she could see faces in the bark. It wasn't like lying on your back and looking at clouds where your imagination did 90% of the work. These were real faces, screaming faces. To Rosie, they looked like women's faces for the most part, women who had been talked to, right up close. After she had walked a little way, she rounded a bend and found the path blocked by a fallen tree which had apparently been struck by lightning at the height of the storm.